you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Joe Atwell back on the show. Joe, how are you doing?
Good, Tim. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for coming back on the show.
My pleasure.
Tonight, well, of course, you are, Joe is an independent scholar, researcher. He is the author of Shakespeare's Secret Messiah and also Caesar's Messiah, the Roman conspiracy to invent Jesus. His website is caesarsmessiah.com, and he also hosts the Secret Society Revealed, a weekly podcast. So, Joe, I was listening to your show, and I think the topic was preempted by current events, the missiles that our new president decided to lob on Syria a few weeks ago. But you and Jerry just briefly just touched on an issue, which is very interesting because, one thing, it's very provocative. But it also requires, I think, further analysis. It's this concept of white privilege, particularly white male privilege, and let's say how it's largely a myth, particularly in the past couple of decades.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think a lot of statisticians have already done work on the claims that were made by the feminists in terms of employment disparaging because of gender. I don't know if you've ever seen any of this stuff, but in general, the you could show that you could put in it like in a some kind of particular variable, like needing to leave your job basically for the length of time that a woman would need to recover from a pregnancy. If you put that into the equation of the sort of labor statistics and of employment and wage earning, most of the advantage that the white male had just disappeared. It was just a question of basically different lifestyles and different educational levels, because at that time the white male was getting a better education. But that there wasn't this kind of structural fairness that people were talking about. This was a myth. And I think, at this point, I'm not even aware of statisticians that argue that case anymore, because so much work has been done showing it wasn't true, but it had a tremendous amount of power, and it began this ball rolling, which ends up with affirmative action, which is both gender and racial promoting of non-white males, right? So, you know, since affirmative action came into existence, there have been some state-level resistance to it. You know, there have been a lot of lawsuits and different states have passed laws. But the federal government continues the practice. And basically, the philosophy of businesses just dramatically changed. And, you know, once the HR individuals started to realize that, you know, the affirmative action needed to get taken care of, well, the next thing you know, we have a kind of a structural situation that's permanent, you know. So now, you know, a lot of companies have they have this, you know, kind of bonus points if you're, you know, a female, bonus points if you're black, so that basically you have to outperform to be a white male. It's very common. I don't have the statistics right in front of me. I was actually trying to get them this afternoon. I couldn't really get what I was looking for. They don't really publish them. I'm not even sure if they exist. But one thing that there is in existence is the health records. And these are so profound that I really hope everybody, you know, when listens to us, kind of does their own research and not take my word or our word for it. I have been wondering about this for some time. I actually have seen, just in my own world, I've seen a lot of deterioration of the health of my peers. I'm going to talk about one individual at some point who just passed away. But I've seen this deterioration, and there are a lot of causes for it. But it is now been shown just to have a very clear statistical basis, because in 2015, two researchers, Ann Case and Angus Deaton, they produced a paper called Rising Morbidity and Mortality in Midlife Among White Non-Hispanic Americans in the 21st Century. And it was incredible, because what they had done is they had simply gotten all of the death certificates, death statistics for the different ethnicities, and created graphs showing, you know, well, how are everything working out? And what they found is that in the white male specifically, there had been a reversal of a long-standing trend toward longer life. And the reversal slowed down in like the 1990s, and then actually turned like around 98. And you started to have a decrease in life expectancies. And this was really, really unusual. Okay, never, you know, I wasn't aware of any example except perhaps during world wars where this had ever happened before. Because, you know, you've had the trajectories based on hygiene and nutrition. So something was happening that was unusual. And these guys, the authors of the paper, the first thing they did was they wanted to see if this was happening to white males everywhere. And they compared U.S. white males in a graph to similar racial cohorts in France, Germany, U.K., Canada, Australia and Sweden, perhaps Austria, and found that they had continued through the entire period to track into longer lives. But in the United States, this wasn't the case. And so there were, they then went into the causes of death. You know, why are they dying? Why are the white males dying more rapidly? And what they found was that the misery index was highly represented in it. In other words, they found that you had suicide, drug and alcohol poisoning, chronic liver disease and cirrhosis were all basically the increased causes of death. And so they actually have a graph in the paper which shows just an incredible increase, for example, in this so-called drug poisonings, alcohol poisonings, from underneath 5 per 100,000 a year to over 30. Just an extraordinary. But they also found very similar kinds of increases in suicides, chronic liver diseases. But lung cancer, on the other hand, was declining, showing that, you know, the fact that they weren't, people aren't smoking was, you know, reflecting in these numbers. In the poisonings, the numbers are simply so tragic that it's almost, you know, hard to believe. But in say 1990, you had fewer than 40 in 100,000 of poisoning, suicides, or liver mortality. But by 2015, it was over 80, over 100% increase. And the graphs are all headed just straight up. So you're clearly are not done with this demographic shift. I, you know, was curious as to what lay behind this sort of change in these causes of death. And it seems to me that the basic, if you look into the causes of death of things that are in the in this so-called misery index category, you know, you have environmental changes, right? So what is it that has changed for this group? Well, you have a couple things. You have affirmative action has had an enormous impact on the chance for these individuals. And incidentally, the deaths were greater in non-college educated white males than in for college educated. But even for that cohort, there was a dramatic increase in deaths. But it was greater in the those that didn't have college degrees. So and then, of course, you have had what I would regard as an assault on sort of the family and an assault on kind of the white male in general by the media. You know, if you look at the white male in television and in movies, very often, not always, but very often, they're characterized as fools. The women are the ones who are clever. They go out of their way to make a joke about sort of the bumbling nature of the white male. And I think that, you know, this is obviously deliberate. There's nothing that, in my opinion, goes on in the media, very little, that isn't basically understood as weaponized anthropology. So I think that, you know, what you're looking at with these numbers, it reflects back to the topics that we've discussed in other shows, which is that the family was the target. That was the general goal of the secret society, right? Following World War II, the United States was triumphant. You'd think that this group, you know, the European Americans could look forward to a really spectacular 100-year run because of the privileged economic position that they held following World War II. All of the competitors had been laid to rubble. But that wasn't to happen, was it? You know, by 1960, just, you know, 17 years from when, you know, the boomers started getting born, you started to see that the culture was under, you know, great duress. The idea of there going to be kind of this middle class paradise, you know, where the ethnic neighborhoods would have peace and prosperity, that wasn't going to happen. Program after program came out of the federal government. You know, Kinsey, he basically laid the groundwork for the federal government's taking over the control of the sexual laws so that pornography would now be commonplace. That all of the various programs to basically move the ethnic neighborhoods into the, what can be called the great deracinated, you know, white middle class, which would be, you know, one step in the wrong direction as far as the defense of culture was concerned. That was all going on. And then you can see, from these numbers that that there was, you know, things that were going to be bringing about increased drug use and alcohol use. And so the mantra of sex, drugs, and rock and roll that the 60s generation adopted, you know, was basically the formula for their destruction. They just didn't know it. And now, you know, all these years later, we can actually look at these statistics as given in this paper, and you can see the real truth that people are dying at an earlier age and that the quality of life has been dramatically reduced. Because, Tim, what you're looking at with these statistics is just the tip of the iceberg. What you're seeing is those that have succumbed all the way to the point of death, right? So, and there's so many of them, it actually skews the statistic. But this is the tip of the iceberg, because in back of this, there is a tremendous cohort of people that are miserable, that are alcoholics, that are drug users, that are financially uncertain. And it is from this huge cohort that, you know, you get these groups that then show up as statistics, you know, of reduced longevity. So I'm really glad the paper is out. I hope everyone, particularly those who have children, white males, but women, you know, need to see this too. You can see that there is just something that is really wrong inside our culture. And, you know, Tim, you and I have talked about this so many times. And it all really comes back to the same thing. I mean, you know, these aren't accidental. This would be like claiming that, you know, the Great Society's program destruction of the black family, the African-American family in the 60s, was accidental or unintended. If that was the case, then they simply could have gotten the statistics were absolutely crystal clear. And they could have changed direction and brought that whole destructive force to an end. But instead, they went forward, showing that there was an agenda, showing that the African-American family was a target. And now here with these statistics, you can see that that the white family was also a target. Because when you look at these statistics, and the, you know, the authors are to be praised. I think these guys, you know, I'm glad that someone is bringing this stuff out. But I don't think they did a really good job of considering cultural causes of these statistics. They talk about economic causes, which, you know, they talk about things like the different natures of the 401ks between Europe and the United States, or, you know, the economic insecurity that was brought about in 2008. But I mean, you know, these are not strong candidates. I mean, you're looking at, when you look at these statistics, you're looking at cultural rot and of a very, very clear and powerful nature. And so the question is, you know, what lay in back of this disaster? And what can be done about it? So, first of all, you know, what lay in back of it? What do you think, Tim?
Well, there is a tendency for those people who to comment or to study these things to write it off as just a series of unfortunate events or natural corruption that sets in an affluent society. And the phenomenon of feminism was a function of prosperity. It's a revolution of rising expectations Even Betty Friedan in The Feminine Mystique complained about boredom being her being what vexed housewives was boredom, not surviving. And so, you know, idle mind being a devil's workshop, you know, what happens? And there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, obviously, I think you said before, society has its own momentum, but there's a prime mover to these things. And I think the research has borne out that behind the scenes, there was a weaponized anthropology put into place at various levels. You mentioned Alfred Kinsey, and there was that Rockefeller, you know, backing. He's legitimizing sexual deviancy in the 1940s and 50s, and this also coincides with the introduction of Playboy magazine in the mid-1950s, which some people think had intelligence agency backing. You have the Time Life Empire promoting drug use, which you and Jan have done extensive research on, with the creation of the Deadhead. The Grateful Dead, it's known it was an intelligence operation. There's speculation with the Beatles, of course, this broad cultural agenda, out of the British Empire. The rise of feminism itself, some people, again, I want to go back to feminism, it was obviously promoted by the foundations, by the government, by the education, institutions, by Madison Avenue, by Hollywood. Normal families were penalized by tax laws. You had, of course, the Great Society programs, which encouraged single parents, single parenting. That's, of course, 90% female. And the marginalization of the black male that was spearheaded by Gloria Steinem, a CIA agent. At this point, obviously there was high-level malfeasance at work here. They were in a position. The thing is, all the forces that were behind this were also in a position to change their macroeconomic environment to make it all that more difficult for the father to be the provider. That's, of course, the inflation of the 70s, high taxes, the introduction of debt to replace, to make up for debasement.
An introduction of welfare checks to replace employment checks.
So, I mean, it's all there. It's the deindustrialization of the United States is all part of the trilateralist agenda. And, of course, we've talked about before, going a little further back in the 1950s, you had the Authoritarian Personality published by the American Jewish Committee in conjunction with MKUltra, CIA, that targeted the father, the Christian father, as the source for fascism in the United States and needed to be targeted. And lo and behold, we see that agenda, over the next 50, 60 years played out, right before our very eyes. And it's hard to make the case that this is all just accidental. I mean, you have to be, you really have to believe in coincidence theory if you buy that.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. The AJC focused on sort of the European in general. And I've read it, and they didn't really focus on the father per se, though they did have, there was a lot in there about, kind of the male and the head of the family. If you actually go through the paper, it's just sort of such crazy stuff that I doubt if anyone's actually read the whole thing, tip to stern. But you can sure read the conclusion where it talks about that in order to prevent, authoritarian personalities or ethnocentric personalities, that we were going to need to organize all of the psychological sciences. Actually say this, we're going to organize them all into a mass scale program, and we would then use Eros rather than in fear and intimidation to bring it about, that the democratic propaganda would be driven by Eros. And then, of course, you get to see Eros and Civilization by Marcuse, and Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, and The Grateful Dead coming out of basically MKUltra and the CIA. And so now, the program that they had suggested has come into existence to the extent that, they were directing it. It's unclear, but it just seems impossible to escape the conclusion that this was basically a strand that led into the MKUltra project, because so many of the same individuals appear in the CIA-related activity, and also in the Macy Conference, and then back to the AJC, where you had basically the whole Frankfurt School being employed for some reason. Anyway, all those things are kind of, I mean, I'm not sure to what extent the listener can follow all that, but it was an overall project that basically was there to crush Christianity, I would say, in a general sense, to make it less effective culturally, to make it less threatening, so that it couldn't really organize itself into something that could basically threaten. And so, you know, we had all of these programs come into effect. We've now been living with them for 50 years. And, you know, it's almost unsurprising to see these dramatic statistics about, you know, increase in suicide, increase in alcoholic and drug overdoses, increases in chronic liver diseases, even though these things had been in decline for 70, 80 years. I mean, you're just looking at the misery that has been brought about by the programs that were initiated by this secret society that used MKUltra, that weird CIA project, as one of its major focuses, but then also pops up with feminism, with Gloria Steinem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, definitely, you know, when you look at, we did that show and we talked about, you know, how you have the funding sources for Ms. Magazine coming right from Operation Mockingbird, the CIA's project to take control of the media. And then you have Clay Felker's, I believe that's how you pronounce his name. When you have him being the person who actually, you know, shepherds Ms. Magazine into existence, and then looking back and seeing that he was with Steinem at Helsinki, he was in the original cell that was there to create violence at the Helsinki youth festivals. Well, it's just as clear as a bell, right? That this brand of feminism, which was a feminism that attacked the family, was part of what they were doing. And then at the same time, you know, you have the media, which promotes, starts promoting non-heterosexual, partners. You have, you have both integration and the gay agenda being, you know, promoted in the media. Well, where did this all take us? You know, we have now, I think this is a pretty good statistic, that there is something that didn't work out real well for the white male. I would bet that you're going to see these statistics also turn in a bad direction for the white female.
Oh, yeah.
It's just going to take a lot, you know, a while longer. They've definitely turned against the African-American male.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what was sold as this, you know, almost brave new world, right? How, you know, integration was sold to the black male as something that was really going to work out great. Well, not if you don't have a family.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't work out great in that context. And so even though all of the moral arguments were correct, I believe, and I think the people that, you know, saw the welfare state and affirmative action in a positive light did so, you know, the African-Americans, I think they did so, you know, not from, you know, not being able to think clearly. It's just that they didn't see, just as the hippie didn't see, you know, where this was actually going to take them in 20 years. Well, now we know the single mom and the non-existent mom. I mean, I was looking at these statistics in inner city. I mean, it just breaks your heart, you know, because you've got, not only is the single mom basically it as far as family structure, but there are a lot of children that don't even have mothers. You know, they're actually being raised by other family members, or just, you know, I mean, it's just beyond belief. And so, you know, we have been attacked, And so we need, you know, as citizens, it's just like warfare. You know, when you're attacked, you have to organize yourself to defend your existence. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a very difficult fight because we're going to be always battling the media. They'll be characterizing the attempt to defend ourselves as sexism, as racism. Mm-hmm. And they'll have sophists, you know, clever arguments to get people to see us in that light. But I think when you look at a lump of statistics like this one, Tim, it's pretty hard not to understand that something really evil was lying in back of the cultural changes that we started to see start happening in the 60s and 70s.
I was reading Roger Devlin's book, Sexual Utopia and Power, and his focus is on female behavior. He puts most of the blame on women. The sexual revolution basically was a revolution in female behavior. And since women kind of, when it comes to sex, they have most of the power, they can either create a condition where monogamy is respected, or they can create a condition where serial polygamy is respected. But he had a quote, he goes, feminism is a movement that thrives on its failures. Hence, it's very difficult to reverse. Mm-hmm. He's right, because its failures are really, I think, are the secret society's successes. And these feminists are just out there. They're the they're the shock troops. You know, they don't know what the higher, you know, they don't know what the larger agenda is.
I mean, I'll give you an example. Betty Friedan, mm-hmm. She basically raised the red flag about Steinem being a CIA agent, mm-hmm. And she was threatened. She was this old line kind of economic Marxist type feminist.
Yeah.
And the next thing you know, she's getting, knocks on the door at 1 o'clock in the morning because she had called out Gloria as a CIA agent. Gloria Steinem as a CIA agent is a really important sort of political fact. And it rivals, in my opinion, the fact about Gordon Wasson, you know, having pay requisition, showing he began, you know, the psychedelic movement, as an MKUltra subproject, because there just isn't any explanation for the CIA promoting Ms. Magazine, right, than to basically debase culture, right? I mean, it just, I would just be astounded if they can explain that one away. And so what they're going to have to do basically is quash it, which is what they did. Steinem attempted and was successful in basically not allowing the Red Stockings to bring out the information about her being an agent. And then when she was found out, she went sophist, and then she had these clever arguments, you know, that, well, I'm still a really good person, and the CIA is a very liberal organization. You know, subsequently, more information just keeps coming out. But I really think that this is an important fact to bring out. I mean, she's still alive. She's still in motion. And you now have a chance to really look at her achievements, right? Because we can really see, she can cite, well, look, we have a lot more abortions now. We have a lot more women in the workforce than ever before. And you know what, Tim? I think it would be a really good idea for her to defend those two things.
Yeah.
Because I think that the average woman would not respond to the reality of what these people have achieved. You know, they could bring these arguments to us, or at least not. I don't even think they would bring these arguments. The abortions, the single moms, the fact that women now have to work and can never really get ahead, these are the kind of the things that come from the philosophy that was put into effect, the legal philosophy. But, you know, it was given to women that they were going to feel terrific about themselves, that this was going to be this a wonderful world. You know, like Steinem had this this statement was like off our backs, you know, was this
Yeah.
Okay, and this was, you know, like, you know, sex is horrible. The family's a bad thing. And you're going to be getting these great jobs because the white male who has a job is stupid and not as qualified as we are. And you're really going to enjoy your life. You won't have that boring family anymore to put up with. Well, you know, now that we've seen the consequence, and women have now had, you know, so many of them, so many of the women from my generation have had lives without husbands. I think that now we would be able to, from a little bit of perspective of experience, answer Steinem's claims about how this is going to be not a worker's paradise, but a feminine paradise. I think most people who basically, in my opinion, were victims of her arguments have become miserable far more than have enjoyed, you know, benefits from the situation. Mm-hmm. Look, everyone is miserable when you have no family, you know. You can, you know, and now, of course, what's going on now is they have, well, yeah, we don't have the male as part of the family, but it's all right because we're lesbians or we're polysexual. You know, they have this pansexual now where they change sexuality. And, you know, I just think that these arguments are obviously perverted, you know, human, you know, kind of lifestyles. They're not, you know, sexually reproductive. But I just think now that enough people have seen, you know, kind of where this has all taken us. And I just think that now is a good time to, you know, to start a counter offensive against this stuff. It's going to be really tough because cultural Marxists are entrenched everywhere.
Yeah, if you're concerned about these things, raise concerns about any of these issues, you're immediately accused of, you know, being a racist or a sexist or,
sure,
you know, a phobe of something, a fear of some whatever perversion is being promoted now, homophobe, transphobe, you know.
Yeah, there's so many sexualities that hard to keep even the phobes straight, you know. But but I just think that there is still a cohort. A large fraction, the largest fraction in our society, is a group of men and women that would understand we've been taken off a cliff.
Mm-hmm. Well, a simple thing like a no-fault divorce, where I think over 70% of divorces are initiated by women, and there's no penalty for that. And you know, why should they get child? You know, why should they be able to get support from the man if she initiates the divorce or get custody of the kids? And simple rules like that. Would inhibit them, but again, you know, another character which would be interesting to look at would be Helen Gurley Brown and her connections. You know, Cosmopolitan magazine, when she wrote "Sex and the Single Girl," promoting, you know, she said women can be sexually aggressive and they go after men who are even married, the most attractive men who are married, and the effect that had is that you have a lot of women chasing, you know, an elite group of good-looking men, and that marginalizes the rest of the men. Whereas in the past, in an era of monogamy, women wouldn't have that choice, and there'd be more women out there for men. One of the mistakes of the sexual revolution was they thought because women were looser sexually that there was more sex for men. I actually didn't mean that at all. I actually mean less sex, because all it meant was that there were a few men getting a lot of sex, and ultimately a lonely life, I think. But a lot of men were marginalized, and so it was a reverse, and it was almost like an embrace of primate mating habits. And don't be surprised if you embrace animal mating habits that society gets degraded into a brute, you know, jungle, and that's what's happening.
Sure.
Now, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, you look at Eros and Civilization, which basically was saying, you know, don't let anything restrain your sexuality. You know, sex with lots of women, sex with animals. I mean, there just really wasn't any kind of sex that was a bad idea to old Herbert. And don't let your personal hygiene get in the way, because you know, that's kind of a bad, like, fascist concept. You
personal
know?
Hygiene, yeah.
Yeah, and so you know, you look at this, and you look at Herbert Marcuse, and, you know, and his, of course, alliance with, you know, feminists and, you know, the whole culture Marxism. And, you know, you got to go back to Gregor Lucas. I really do think it's something that people just need to automatically do. You know, when you see like the effect, see, when you see Miley Cyrus, right, and you see her basically trying to mimic a dog, right, having sex on stage, right, and look at, in trying to actually, you know, I mean, I'm not just talking about the physical motions. I mean, her getup, you know, she's actually trying to look like an animal. And she takes her tongue and extends it as far as she can out, you know, just to kind of finish up this bestiality symbolism. So you look at that and you go, okay, well, you know, you can really see Marcuse had a lot of effect. You know, this is part of sex, drugs, rock and roll. Everything looks clear cut. But then you have to remember, Marcuse is from the Frankfurt School, and this does come from Gregor Lukacs. And so now you can look at Lukacs, and you can look at the Bella Kuhn giving old Gregor the control over sex education in Hungary following World War One. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, you know, obviously he had the same perspective as Herbert, or should I say that Herbert was reflecting Lukacs's, because he was the founder of the Frankfurt School, which then brings cultural Marxism into America. And so you've got a pretty clear trajectory, not too hard really to follow it, is it, Tim? You know, from Gregor to the Frankfurt School to Herbert, and then into MK Ultra, followed by Miley Cyrus and miming bestiality on the MTV award show. It's just basically, it's not that hard to keep all the connections coherent as you try to go through the trajectory. This didn't happen accidentally, right? It did not. This happened because people who were studying psychology, anthropology, and had control over the media were able to bring it about. So this is the bad news for all of our listeners. You know, this is really bad news because it means that you know, we have been not only attacked, but attacked in a very sophisticated way. In a way it's going to be really hard to unravel from, but first step is just, you know, I would say just start out with the mortality rate and the causes for the mortality rate of the white male and just start working backwards. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to end up at Gregor Lukacs, right? You know, the proletariat rebellion that Marx envisioned, which was going to basically be the complete destruction of the Christian world, looked like it was going to be a little harder to bring about than they thought. You know, it was just difficult to get these esoteric philosophies widely held enough to get people to go to war over. And so another force came into existence, which is this cultural Marxism.
Yeah, long march to the institutions. Yeah,
the more long march to the institution. Now, it's interesting. Jerry Russell told me that there isn't a cultural Marxist Wikipedia page because whenever they try to get it up, they attack it and it goes into these complicated referee situations. But he said that basically there is kind of a link to it as a manifestation of the Frankfurt School or something, or, you know, and
okay,
so yeah. But you can see that this is a concept that, even though that it's, I mean, it's just absolutely self-evident that it exists and that it has this enormous political force, but that they don't want you to do any investigation regarding, you know, it's sort of to me like Gloria Steinem's, you know, long-standing project to be a CIA agent, as being a CIA agent, that they don't want this study because it goes straight to the fact that Ms. Magazine and the form of feminism, which was itself a deviation from the long-standing economic feminism that had been in America, that the cultural feminism, which was against you know, the family, right? The feminism that Steinem was talking about, which was promoting abortion, promoting free sex with whoever you wanted, you know, promoted, you know, the, of course, it also had the idea that the women would you know, not have to be suffering a family so they could be in the workforce. But if that feminism could be shown to come from the CIA, then people would start wondering, well, wait a second, you know, what is the CIA? What has driven this institution to, you know, both create the counterculture and feminism? You know, and once that question becomes widely asked, I think it's just, you know, it's going to be really clear to the population that they wanted to create basically a population that would be just so fragmented and impotent that they would have a kind of intellectual dictatorship over it.
Yeah, like in Brave New World, which
exactly are right
entertained, and also that sex is weaponized to distract everybody.
Brave New World, sex and soma, drugs and sex are there just to keep people from realizing that they're slaves. And the drugs and sex work until you don't want to do what you're told to do, which, of course, in Brave New World isn't going to happen because in the future, the oligarchs will have the control over our minds. You won't even have the ability to develop a thought of rebellion or develop the idea that maybe, you know, being a delta is a bad thing. That will never occur because that, you know, they'll have conditioned it into us. And if there is anxiety, then they give us the drugs. And if we continue, you know, to complain, they'll just execute us. So this is, you know, what they've wanted. It's not hard to understand conceptually that this would be the kind of dictatorship, permanent technologic dictatorship that would be attractive to the secret society, and it also would go very neatly with the fact that it's so many of the points along the way where you see, you know, the dictatorship getting ratcheted up, you see little clumps of anthropologists and psychologists, right? You know, if you look at MK Ultra, you look at the American Jewish Committee, you look at the Frankfurt School, you just have these little clumps of anthropologists. They're studying, they're giving, you know, they don't talk about the agenda, but in fact, you know, it is visible.
Well, they do it through culture. The Rand Corporation consulted on Star Trek. The idea of the UN, they're pushing the UN agenda there. And, you know, so this is how it's done. And it's not just, you know, crude or overt means. It's subtle through the culture. And that's why, you know, I mentioned Helen Gurley Brown and Cosmopolitan and how that affected female sexuality. Promoting female irresponsible sexual behavior, and you know the whole idea of the male sexuality being evil. That's the whole date rape, you know, hysteria thing that kicked in the I guess at the 80s or 90s, more the 90s, I guess. But you could create a condition you do in your typical college campus and not expect that problem to occur. Obviously, that problem is going to occur. In fact, that's why it was. You know, if you create co-ed dorms and you create a situation where teenagers are sent away from home.
And promote alcohol and drug use by the entire population. And then you stand in horror and go, oh, my God, how did this happen?
It's disingenuous. That's the worst thing.
Well, there are rapes because the condition by which they can occur, the culture by which they can occur, is the most powerful one. And so you can't try to just go after the symptom of the cultural degradation. See, I think this is what you're getting, and I'm sorry to have stepped on your point here, but it's just, you know, you're not going to affect any change with, you know, draconian, you know, punishments. I mean, obviously, believe me, you know, rape is just the most destructive crime that exists.
Yeah, so you shouldn't trivialize it by creating different categories.
Right.
You shouldn't
permit a culture, you know, where you have same-sex dorms, right?
Yeah. It's,
I mean, that's why you had separate sex dorms.
Yeah, you had to, like, if you old movies where you're meeting a girl, she had to come down and meet you, and you know,
yeah,
and one thing is, another point that Roger Devlin made in Sexual Utopia and Power is it is an idea that the more you see girls, the more likely you have sex. Well, actually, that's not the way it works, because the familiarity will disillusion you about each other, and you end up not liking each other as much. Whereas if you only saw a guy once or twice a week or at the dance, gives you a chance to get to know him and also idolize him a little bit. So there's some chance for romance there.
Well,
this whole notion of breakdown of modesty is ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, all these things. But I mean, the debutante culture produced families. Say what you want about its artificiality, it sure was statistically a success, right?
Yeah.
So now you have, well, gee, look, you know, we're so liberated, and you have no families.
Well, compare the debutante ball to hooking up. Which would you prefer?
Exactly.
Which is more disgusting? Come on.
And the thing is that's a question that should be presented to women, because that's really the dichotomy that was given to them by Steinem, right? You know, Steinem talks about, hey, it's, you know, have sex the way you want it and under your terms, right? Okay, forget the debutante culture. That's you know, for slaves, right? But the problem is, you end up with, you know, sex with dozens of men and no husband, and that didn't really, that's really was
yeah.
That's not something that women really wanted. So, you know, it's, we talked about this in the last show, that you just have to go backwards. You've got to, you know, we've seen what has happened. We've seen the groups that have brought the weaponized anthropology. We know what our culture was like. I know it was square. I know a lot of people were unhappy with its effects. You know, there was racial discrimination. Mm-hmm. There was stuff that was really unfair for women. But we need to try to fix our culture, these problems, in the context of retaining a culture.
Yeah. Right. If racial discrimination didn't mean that ethnic identity was wrong, nor did it mean that, or male authority in a family, just because there are some incidents, you know, women may have been discriminated against or treated poorly at times, or doesn't mean that male authority is wrong in a family. It's like you take the worst example of something and then say, you know, throw it out. That's ridiculous. Well, are women really better off without husbands? Are children really better off without fathers? Well, the thing is, they think so because it's not about the children. It's about, ultimately, it's about depopulation and genocide. So,
right. And, you know, of course. That's right. You see, I actually have a theory. Of course, I'm old-fashioned. But I think one of the reasons why they initiated, the MKUltra counterculture and feminism is that the culture was getting close to really being a kind of utopia. In other words, if you'd taken the 1950 culture and had continued a lot of the trajectories mm-hmm. that are visible in the statistics, I think you would have had a socialization. I think the males would have been, the fraction that were too dominant could have been brought into a better orbit. I think the lack of kind of intellectual activity that some women were seeing, you know, inside of marriages, I think this could have been addressed. In other words, the problems that we had, I think, were going to get solved, and I think they knew it. They could see the trajectories, and they could go, wait a second, these people won't be controllable. You know,
look at the indices for the black family from 1945 to 1960. Everything was improving.
That's right.
You know, even crime rates. People think that crime rates are endemic to black culture. You hear that argument made all the time. Well, the tail off, the collapse began in the mid '60s. It's relatively recent, really, if you think about it. I think Irish had a higher illegitimacy rate and crime rate than blacks did up until the middle of the century.
I think I told the story. Yeah,
But they didn't want that to happen. They didn't want that because it was occurring without any social engineering.
Exactly. You know, it was the people just improving themselves and heading and trying to take our world, the world that, in other words, our lives, into a place where there would be peace and happiness.
Mm-hmm.
we were moving in this direction, right? Everyone could feel it. I remember in the 50s what it was like. And I think that the African-American really had that strong sense. And so the next thing you know, it isn't just that the African-American family gets hit with the welfare state, which takes the male out of the, he doesn't produce the income anymore, and separates him from the family.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also have the pimp culture being glamorized, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to be getting a lot of now males with single moms. And then at the same time, I think that the drugs that were brought into the inner city were done so deliberately.
Yeah.
And by the same people who were producing MK Ultra of counterculture. And so now that you've had this combination that now creates, at the same time that jobs are starting to leave en masse from manufacturing jobs that could have been available to inner city kids. I mean, it's just tragic when you think about what they did to them.
Mm-hmm.
How they outsource the manufacturing job, they insource the drug culture, right? They promoted the pimp as the pimp concept as kind of a glamorous, valuable thing for them to head to, and then they separated they atomized the family. They got rid of the father, and so now, 60 years later, 50 years later, you can see the result.
Mm-hmm. Look at Detroit. I mean, geez.
That's right.
One of the most beautiful cities.
Yeah.
At one point, and there's just destroyed. A lot of them is municipal corruption, union corruption. But also, there was a broader agenda there at play. And if you mentioned the integration was weaponized, given the cover of racial integration and justice and all that, but they were used as proxies. The mass migration north to weaken the unions, and the same reason that women were mobilized in the 70s, ultimately in the 80s, they could flood the job market and lower wages.
Yeah, and something I learned from you, which was really had a strong effect on me, is that the white middle class was deracinated deliberately, right? They couldn't move, to kind of integration with other races. So they took these neighborhoods and moved them all into a deracinated white middle class state. And they knew that that was a step toward basically being able to get rid of the ethnicity altogether.
Yeah.
It was like a halfway point that they took the ethnic, the Italian, Polish, Irish, German, all of the ethnic neighborhoods that had the extended families. They got pushed out into this deracinated white middle class suburb, and the kids then were basically vulnerable to the pornographic culture.
Yeah, the deal here in America prior, I guess, in the middle part of the 20th century on up into the middle part of the 20th century, until right after the Second World War, was that ethnic Germans would come here, Poles would come here, Irish would come here, and they'd become Americanized to a certain extent, but they'd retain a huge portion of their ethnic identity. They become Irish Americans, German Americans, in these ethnic enclaves. And so America was really an archipelago of different ethnic areas, and that was probably the that's probably what you really want, because that way you have community, you have family, you have whether it's the parish, the extended family, and you work in the area, but they didn't want that. They had a Cold War agenda. They wanted, it was the American century, and they needed to destroy that. And they were able to exploit real problems like the racial problems. But you don't solve racial problems by shipping. I think it was like in a 6-month period in World War II, they shipped like 200,000 former black sharecroppers and dumped them into right near Detroit in the Polish neighborhood. And what do you think's gonna? Don't give them housing accommodation when you could have built housing elsewhere and had their own little community. It wouldn't be a problem. But it was designed to create a problem, and it was exposed in the 70s that Sergeant Shriver, when he was head of the Economic Employment, the Office of Economic Opportunity, one of these boondoggles of the 60s, that they had given almost $1 million to this black gang, the Blackstone Rangers, and they knew they were criminals. The idea was this was to chase the whites out, to make it life unlivable. So don't give me this racial integration BS. It's not. I mean, and not to mention the fact that it's an insult to every ethnic group. This is everyone has to meld together, you know, to be of any value. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, I think integration was a goal because ultimately they wanted a completely deracinated Delta class, you know, like Brave New World. That was the goal, but that wasn't the integration that they were selling people in the 70s, the values that they were claiming for it. I mean, it was, again, just the population didn't have the capacity to defend itself because it did not suspect malfeasance.
Yes, and then people still don't. It's almost like
they still don't,
today, right? Today, whether it's this weaponized, you know, the aggressive gay agenda, which is no longer just let us be, leave us alone. It's aggressive, and people don't realize how it's being actively promoted within the schools, the whole thing with the media. And it's not just, you know, some, you know, uncoordinated culmination of events. No, it's a weapon. It's a weapon that's being pointed at you. You know, the broader weaponization of culture that most people, you know, well, good example, like the suburbs, how this was done. Is you get them in the suburbs, and then, you know, this lasts maybe a generation, and then the economy turns sour, and in order to support that suburban lifestyle, you need two incomes. And now with mommy out of the house and kids coming home to an empty house, you know, they watch cable television. And they watch MTV, and they're taken in by the vampires at MTV. And I was talking to somebody who's talking about the sexual revolution. The sexual revolution was there to kind of break up, increase the divorce rate, break up traditional families, and so that this occurs in the 70s and going into the 80s, where divorce becomes more common. And in broken homes, you have kids that are subject to much more trauma and abuse, and this produces a lot of the I believe the sexual confusion that we're seeing today, because one of the major causes of that, I think, is absentee fathers and different fathers, or abuse, and in single family homes, the abuse rate skyrockets. And
well, so, I mean,
single parent homes, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, a media where 50% of the content is glorifying homosexual relationships.
Yeah, and if you watch the latest, and pathologizing or characterizing heterosexual relationships as dysfunctional.
Sure.
I mean,
remember, the statistics that actually came about by researchers who followed Kinsey, thinking that his claims for the rates of homosexuality and lesbianism were too high. I mean, what they found was that lesbianism was a half of 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And gay men were like less than 2% of the population.
Yeah.
So now you have these television shows where, lesbian and gay relationships are literally at 50% of, you know, sexual activity that's represented. Well, where does this come from? You know, it doesn't reflect, anything that was real. It simply reflects, unfortunately, what they want to do with the population, which is to create these non-family producing sexualities.
Mm-hmm. And another part of the attack of the white male, obviously the sexual revolution, sure. is you break up the family and you increase the divorce rate. And or even if you have a woman who's employed out of the house, he's not going to get the maintenance that a man would have gotten in a traditional relationship, like prepared meals and support. And
The thing is, you have to have two incomes, so the mom isn't going to be able to be a stay-at-home mom. I mean, like families that have stay-at-home moms are extraordinary in terms of their income. And what happened was is that the dollar, the wages, were debased because the Federal Reserve stole the wealth through interest that it charged the American citizens on money it invented out of thin air, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it was debasing the currency, debasing the buying power of the currency. I mean, gold was $50 an ounce You know, in the 1950s, it's, you know, $1,250 an ounce now. Mm-hmm. And so this just shows the fact of the currency debasement that, you know, means that, you know, you've got to have the two incomes. You know, it doesn't have to be this way, Tim.
And also the psychological warfare is promoting the consumer culture, whereas people think they need things when they don't. If you look at a household in 1970, and let's imagine you had the accoutrements and the luxuries of a 1970 household you do today, you'd find your budget would be would be a lot less. And also, if you do the math, even with employment, is most people barely break even when it comes to the cost of a wardrobe, commuting time, just the stress level.
Everyone's going broke.
Yeah. And
like over 50% of the population basically has nothing. I think it's probably, and these statistics I think are actually optimistic. I think probably that 80% of Americans have no savings and no future, no economic future really. Mm-hmm. And so this is what they've been able to do to us. They did it incrementally and so slowly that no one really noticed that was going on. And they, you know, had propaganda that was always being given to the people about, you know, they hate us for our freedoms.
Yeah.
You know, we've had this great, the sexual revolution was really, you know, a valuable cultural event. You know, feminism has really had these great results and the Federal Reserve is your friend. Well, you know, I mean, I want to talk about a worker's paradise, Tim. And my worker's paradise in my manifesto is America 1953. You know, that's the worker's paradise. That was when there were unions, when the currency wasn't being debased, hadn't been debased, where moms could stay at home with a, you know, a husband who had a normal type job, right? Just nothing out of the ordinary. People could own their homes, where the public schools reflected the ethnic communities that people grew up in, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, this is a worker's paradise. You know, now that worker's paradise, very peaceful. You know, I mean, I know, you know, you say, well, some women were unhappy. Look at there's racial discrimination. You know, okay, nothing is perfect. But those problems could have easily been solved from that platform.
Yeah, without destroying.
Now they're never going to be solved. I mean, you look at the disparity, the economic and kind of cultural differences between like the enclave whites now and the inner city youth. I mean, when you have an economic catastrophe, you're just going to have a bloodbath, mm-hmm. you know, because everyone's going to be out there with automatic weapons defending their little plot of turf. So, you know, we just permitted very clever anthropologists, sociologists to design government policies that ended up in our current situation. With a debased currency, with a debased family structure, and with debased sexuality, and we're in a fix at this point because we're so close to the stage where I think they can do you know, large scale population reduction, because how are you going to resist? So anyway, it's time to, and I mentioned this the last show, it's just an all-hands work party. The questions that really need to be answered, the information that needs to be disseminated is, you know, why did they create the counterculture? Why did they create feminism? Who are the individuals inside government, the secret society? I mean, you can see an outline, right? It's pretty easy. You got the secret societies, right? Bohemian Grove, the Freemason, CFR, and you've just got a ton of Jewish anthropologists, sociologists. A good place to look is there's a video that's on YouTube called A Conversation About LSD, and it's absolutely fascinating. Jan Urban and I have deconstructed the conversation, which anybody who knows anything about MK Ultra can just see that these groups are just the group is just lying their heads off. But you've got a whole bunch of secret society guys, and you've got all of these, you know, this individuals that have these backgrounds in anthropology and stuff. And it's there that we can start. It's one of the places we can start to kind of understand, well, who were they? What was the motivation? How do they control government? You know, because you looked at now and people, you know, thought Trump was going to drain the swamp. and I was telling him, you know, before, you know, the election was even close, I was saying, nah, you know, he is dirty. He's been handpicked. You can see, like with Trump, because of, you know, his family background, the connection with Roy Cohn, which is, you know, obviously a problem. And the worst red flag is the fact that Trump's uncle was given Nikola Tesla's his intellectual estate for vetting, and then he removed it from public. You know, no one ever saw it after they gave it after he did the review. So you can just see that his family is wired into the guild somehow. We need to get genetic testing to know exactly how he is. But I knew Trump was just a lifetime actor. But I was going to mention that one thing that everyone can help with is. We need expressions to be able to understand, you know, what's going on. Like, it's really useful now that the expression false flag is something that people, you know, they know what it means. Mm-hmm. And the concept weaponized, this is, you know, it's very valuable to have that term, you know, so people can understand weaponized feminism, weaponized integration, weaponized anthropology. And another term I hope gets very popular is lifetime actor, so that when they go, well, gee, you know, Donald Trump, he's just this pompous, crazy billionaire guy. He's not some kind of secret society. No. Lifetime actor. A lifetime actor could spend a long time developing the role that he's going to use to, you know, basically have some influence in culture with. Look at Gordon Wasson, you know, the guy who created the beginning of the counterculture, the beginning of the influence of psychedelic drugs. I mean, you know, he claimed that he had this, he was just fascinated by mushrooms, right? So lifetime actor, that's a really valuable, and see, if we get these terms, if we get a vocabulary, then it'll help people's minds sort of organize reality. You know, and to bring up the right questions, like Obama, right? Well, gee, you know, everything looks great. He's got an Arabic name. He's black. He's really going to stop the wars. And, you know, because he's a black community activist from Chicago, we're going to get some social justice where the bankers are going to get their comeuppance for stealing all this money in the 08 financial crisis. And then look what happens. Obama invades Afghanistan, plays golf, doesn't arrest a single banker. Well, he's a lifetime actor. Mm-hmm. He's just created. It's a role that he was given at a very early age, no doubt. And then now he's been living it, you know, pretending to be this individual. But always he's had the connections into the secret society. Always he's been someone that they could rely on to do their bidding.
Yeah, all his political opponents were taken down for him.
Yeah, well, once they get the guy, you know, in mind, they just there they go because look, the democracy is fake, right? Since the media is controlled, the democracy is fake. I mean, you know, Tim and Joe, we don't know Obama, we don't know Donald Trump. He doesn't invite us to Jupiter Island, so we're only. You know, having these images given to us by this all-powerful media. Well, if the media is fake, then there is no democracy.
Yeah,
we're choosing between, you know, people that they create.
But that's that realization. People invest so much emotional energy and time into these figures that were presented to us on the screen.
Yeah,
you know, it's a screen. It's a show, yeah. And yet people really think they know who this person is, what he stands for, or who she stands for. and they're just put up there. It's amazing to me that people don't double, you know, when they're watching the news, they actually think they're watching a presentation of information when really they're watching a production for your manipulation. Mass communication has always been for mass manipulation. It was studied for that effect. I mean, I think Jan did the thing on the Radio Research Project out of Princeton, and Orson Welles and the stuff, and all the reporters that we've been presented, Walter Cronkite, came out of OSS and OWI. They're all intelligence agents, or actors like, what's his name? The guy in London, Edward R. Murrow, was a stage actor.
Yeah.
This is London. This whole tactic of breaking into a show to give you news, it's all manipulation, because that's what Orson Welles did. I remember on War of the Worlds. We interrupt this program to give you, and they do it with regular news. Just like, remember, Fox News had for years after 9/11, they had that Fox alert and the swooshing sound.
And it's interesting, like in the War of the Worlds, where they did that experiment with, H.G. Wells' crazy, aliens from outer space, mm-hmm. and Orson Welles, presented it and to the public, and supposedly a lot of people thought it was real and there was panic. Well, the Princeton Radio Project, which produced it, had, people from the American Jewish Committee, Adorno.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And it also had Leventhal, who was an MKUltra psychologist. So you can see that this was just one of the guild was doing an experiment to determine, what is believed by masses of people concerning communication of this kind. So, that was just, an experiment that, was part of this whole process by which they could basically then create television. And then you have CBS, with William Paley from the OSS and the all-seeing eye staring back out at you. I mean, it's just ludicrous, right?
Yeah. If you look at entertainment, it's gone. It's progressively isolating, right? You go from theater, we go with people. You're at the park hearing a band play, or where to the point where now you're watching television. You're just with your family or by yourself. Then you get multiple televisions. You're just watching television by yourself, and now we've gone through with the internet and these little devices where people just, are becoming low spectrum autistic individuals, just staring into the screen, walking around.
Yeah. And now, they're getting all these apps where you don't even have to be at home to watch, something as stupid as ESPN. You can just hit the app and there it is, So basically the media can just follow you everywhere. Yeah. It's really a destructive force. No question.
And the technology there, think something like augmented reality or virtual reality, where technology improves, they're going to be able to create an environment that is so attractive that people are going to shrink from reality and want to indulge in virtual reality or augmented reality.
But what you're really looking at is just the implementation of Huxley's Brave New World. Yeah. Because once the devices get sophisticated enough where they'll be able to tell your emotions just by, the sweat glands it can detect on its, then they'll basically just control you like a robot.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, and has always been the plan.
Yes.
And the individuals in Brave New World, at the lower levels are unthinking. They've just been conditioned and have very low intelligence genetically. And they're given soma to handle any stress they might have from these lives that they have to live. So they're basically like a biological robot. Well, that's what the goal has been. And now these things are being brought about for that purpose. And it's, this old story, Tim, where what's presented to the public is the paradise. Here's the iPhone. Here's the apps. Look how useful it is, right? Here's the workers' paradise. Here's the Politburo. Look how everything is going to be great. Here's feminism. This is just terrific. Here's sex, drugs, and rock and roll, Tim. That's going to work out wonderfully for you, right?
Yeah.
So you always are given these stories about, culture is going to change, but everything is going to be better. The problem is that it ends up with everything being worse every single time. The slavery becomes more and more intense. The intelligence becomes less and less. The production of any kind of cultural energy that could resist this dictatorship is diminished. So, you know, we have to reject the story that is being given to us about the iPhone, about the, you know, the values of it. We have to try to use social media while we still have the minds to think, to basically see if we can create an organized resistance.
Yeah. You know, well, simple things like if you're a parent, don't buy one for your kid.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, people, parents, just they acquiesce. They surrender their authority to these things. Well, everyone's doing, you know, these family data plans. Oh, great.
Yeah.
I mean, do you really need this? I mean, do you really need this? I mean, come on.
I think that what we want are, you know, to create family internet free zones. You know, where families come together. I mean, of course, this is idealistic, but I mean, this is kind of a direction to head in. See if you can, you know, if I had children in my house again, that would be something I'd be just desperately trying to do, is to find other families that had the same kind of political perspective that I do, so that then we could meet and socialize our children in environments that we control.
Yeah, and that's been completely lost with the internet. That's, you know, people used to be aware of these threats, and you know, but with the internet and I guess the Communications Decency Act, which really is the Indecency Act of 1996, where they allowed for transmitting of pornography on the internet. But again, it's one of these things where the technology becomes it becomes such a convenience or a necessity with your work, and they really work you over so you get used to it, and pretty soon you become to depend on it for everything you do, and then that's where they got you, because you know,
that's right. I really wonder about the effects of pornography on young males, especially. I really am worried about this, because I am afraid that the effects will really be long lasting.
Yeah, they'll drop out. Who wants to deal with a real girl? I mean,
right.
Then you have the girl on the other equation, all the girls themselves who have, you know, they've lost all sense of, in many ways, lost a lot of their sense of modesty or how to interact with males in a healthy way. You get
sure.
that, you know, the college, you know, campuses with the feminists and the date rape, activists and Take Back the Night stuff. It's really Take Back the Night is just every man's a rapist. Could be a rapist, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah, you know, and you can just see that the BS where they will focus the media, the campus media, on this idea that the males are all potential rapists, right? Mm-hmm. But have no response or criticism at all of the massive pornography.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
So we're here to persecute and make everyone paranoid about the males. Okay, well, fine. But what about the massive pornography that's coming into the campus vis-a-vis the iPhone and the internet? Mm-hmm. Does this have any effect at all on these rape situations? And since it obviously does, why aren't you attacking that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that would require going back to maybe an old-fashioned way of doing things, like doing with co-education, perhaps, or segregated dorms, at least, or something. But they don't want this, because all these things are social experiments. If anyone ever goes to a college orientation with a parent, you'll get that, where this is your chance to be away from your parent and experiment. That's the whole tone. And why do parents feel compelled to pay for that? Why do they feel compelled to pay for college education? That's another question you got to ask themselves. Is it college education? Is it really an education? Or is it indoctrination? And does it really pay anymore? And is the purpose of education that you land some sort of mediocre middle class job, or is it you get an education? And if so, then why are you supporting these large institutions that are destroying your children? I mean,
I mean, there is no greater cesspool in the United States than the university system. I mean, it is just absolutely disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
We just need to put that thing out of existence. It is just a cesspool of cultural Marxism. And the thing is, it's such a weapon. You know, it damages the kids so severely mm-hmm. when they go through it because, you know, I don't want to name schools, but, you know, I had kids in the Ivy League and, you know, I had, we would visit and spend time in the dorms. I mean, it's just beyond belief. You know, everything is same sex. There is just a culture of sexual hookup, you know, just everywhere. And of course, drugs are just, you name it. And this supposedly, we're in these like elite schools with supposed students and stuff. I mean, it was just beyond belief. It just would, I'm just sort of a curious person. And because of that, I really wanted to get into like the dorm lives of these schools. And so when I was there, I really, you know, kind of nosed around and got a chance to go inside. It was just beyond belief. And the other thing that I found was just so shocking is prescription drug use. Yes. Adderall and antidepressants. I mean, I think half the kids are on these things, you know.
They were taking, I had some kids, my brother as business employees, college kids, and they were talking about how they casually take some of these drugs to help them focus on tests.
Yeah.
And then they wonder why the suicide rate is going up.
Because, no,
that's a letdown, and of course, when you talk about the college system, it feeds right into the pharmacological medical industrial complex. And of course, we all know about it's the college, the university system's links to MK Ultra.
Yeah,
you know.
And well, I had a personal experience. It's so raw, it's even hard for me to talk about it. But I had a very good friend pass away over the weekend. He had cancer. I've known him my whole life virtually. He was a white male who didn't make it to 70, no family, was a drug addict, and was given just the worst imaginable medical advice, right? Had lymphoma because he'd been taking drugs for his hepatitis C, I'm sure of it. And then they gave him chemotherapy and then radiation. And then, of course, you know, a year later, the stuff is back. And then they say, well, you can have stem cells or hospice. In which case, you know, if you want hospice, then even though I think there was a chance, I believe, that he could have recovered, you know, they put you in these situations where you're getting 20 milligrams an hour of morphine. And, you know, I don't think many people come out of hospice.
No, I think some people say it's designed to expedite your death.
And it's you have to do to make, you know, that's my suspicion. I was very angry about this because I've actually worked with a guy for a couple years who's had throat cancer. Really lovely, smart guy. And he just, when he came down with it, he looked at the statistics and he said, you know, forget all of the stuff that the AMA is peddling. I don't want any of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually just walked away from it. And so I had a chance to actually, because he lives out of the country, but I was on Skype with him almost every day. And I was my friend who after his lymphoma treatment, because he had no family, had nowhere to go, he lived with me while he was trying to recover. So he was there for 3 months. So I really had this interesting opportunity to see the different reactions to the different approaches. And in the guy who was out of the country who wasn't using any of the AMA stuff, he took like oxygen, massive doses of vitamins. He had all kinds of different approaches with how to deal with it. And then mainly nutrition. He was really very, very careful about diet. And he went out of his way to get the kinds of vegetables that, you know, supposedly had this good effect. And I saw him go from kind of low energy because he was fighting big tumors. You could see him. And after a couple of years, his energy level was high. His consciousness was brilliant, bright. He was just full of energy. It was amazing. And the tumors were reduced. And then my other friend, it wasn't just that the chemo and the radiation failed, but his mind was gone after the treatments. And they never came back. And this is something, again, it goes right into the white male, you know, kind of situation we were talking about earlier, is that this is this is the medicine that's waiting for you at the end of the cultural assault. The medicine is the cherry on the sundae, and it'll finish you off, because I saw my poor friend come down with what's called chemo brain. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've
I've heard of it.
Well, I mean, he couldn't remember anything.
Yeah.
You know, and he went from someone who's really quite literate, you know, he had been a drug addict, he had a lot of problems, but he was very smart, very kind of a clear mind in a lot of ways. And after the chemo, he never regained it. He was always confused, basically. And his energy was just, you know, well, he was 6'3", weighed 133 pounds. So it wasn't very energetic. And then eventually it all fell apart, and the disease came back, and then they gave him the hospice and he passed away. Well, the fact is that even if the person, I don't want to give his first name, you know, because but even if the person who was using the natural approach had failed and died, he would have still been the right approach, because his consciousness was brilliant. He was full of energy and life and health, right? Mm-hmm. And his mind was always good. Whereas my other friend, he after the treatment, he was never the same again. And so, you know, you really, the oncologists, man, don't get me started. I mean, they've been
trained in a certain way, in Rockefeller medicine.
They never talked about nutrition.
No.
They never talked about anything that might produce a healthy immune system, right? They just had drugs for everything.
And the drugs destroyed the immune system.
Exactly. Yeah. And so anyway, it was just, it was something, and then he passed away Saturday night, and it was like, you know, and I could never get him to kind of turn the corner. I introduced him to my other friend online so we could actually have conversations with him and things. But his trust in the kind of oncology medical science was absolute. He just wasn't going to budge. Yeah. And so, you know, sad. But anyway, that's I know it's a small sample size, but these are just the two friends I had who had cancer over the last 3 years. And I'll tell you, it was just no question which one was the which one had made the right choice.
But I imagine you, the friend who passed away probably spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in drug treatments over the course.
Oh, God. I mean, it's just, yeah. I mean, yeah. And of course, the taxpayer picks up all of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a harvesting system. That's what it is. Yeah. It's basically they get you throughout life and near the end of life. But that's one way they can get you, is through the medical industrial complex and these drugs that will hasten your demise, kill everything, including the cancer. That's the problem. But then when it comes back, you have no immune system left over. So
yeah, and you know, I hate to like see conspiracies everywhere, but I had some communication with the hospice, you know, entity, and then I also was able to look into some of the statistics and the philosophies, and I don't want to talk specifically about the one that he was in, but my take after studying hospice is that, man, I would not put anyone that I knew in such a facility under any circumstances. If they need morphine for pain management, just give it to them at home, for God's sakes. You know, you basically lose all capacity to control what goes on to your loved one once they go inside these facilities. And the morphine schedule that they're legally able to take people onto, because they have this ability to do whatever they need to do for pain management. Man, I spent like a better part of, when I found out, you know, that he passed away, I was studying on it. you know, I just don't see how the morphine schedules that they have, which were when they get over 20 milligrams an hour, man, I don't see how anyone can live for more than a week.
Yeah, it just destroys. Yeah.
Well, because, you know, you stop, you can't breathe. You know, you're not getting enough oxygen in, and because your breathing is slowed down so much, and the morphine is interfering also with the uptake of the oxygen in the blood system. So, I mean, I just think you're suffocating to death. I want to do a little more research before I come out swinging on this one, but I didn't like what I saw, and I was, you know, and the fact is that I just think a lot of people will have remission from the diseases. But once you go into these facilities, you're kind of in a machine. I mean, I'm not going to say they're malevolent, but I do think it's mechanical. And, you know, if they see you're in discomfort, well, it's just more morphine.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's the white male. I mean, you know, you're going to get cancer if you're lucky enough to avoid a drug overdose.
Mm-hmm. Something to look forward to.
And then you'll have your morphine waiting for you. So, you know, it is not a good situation. And we are all suffering from it. We're all suffering from it. The friend who turned away from the AMA left the United States because he said it just wasn't healthy enough. He says, look, you know, I'm fighting for my life. I need to have really a pure environment.
So
he went to some place where, you know, he says the food is just naturally healthy. And that made a huge difference, he said. So anyway, you know, we've got the toxicity, the plastics in the environment, the chemtrails, the media, which, you know, is basically portrays heterosexuality as a perversion. And then we have the secret society controlling the media, the military, the finance, and the politicians. So this is the white male privilege, Tim.
Yeah.
This is our truth. And you know something? It's been like this for 100 years. The secret society benefits from slavery, from world war, from munition factories, from racism. The common white European male, Tim, we're the ones that walk into the automatic weapon fire.
Go over the top for King God King.
That's what we do well.
Yeah.
We go over the top, right? And the problem is there's some other poor bastard from the same perspective, the same, you know, ethnic background. He's coming at me from the other side,
mm-hmm.
right? So, you know, my opinion, the wars are fake. They're just there to reduce the population of certain groups. The secret society controls the military intelligence and the media. It's all just one, you know, the entertainment intelligence complex, to use an expression, is absolutely fake, right? It makes a representation of being for us, but it's just something that's there to hurt us. And, you know, and the quicker the population catches on to this stuff, the better. So, you know, I'm hoping we can do a lot more shows, Tim, and just keep sounding the alarm, because I'm hoping we'll reach a point where you won't need to stimulate so much with presentations in the internet. I'm hoping that, you know, you get like 10 times the number of people who are aware of the concepts, you know, of weaponized feminism, weaponized anthropology, that understand lifetime actors, right? You get to that point where instead of a few hundred thousand, you've got 100 million or 50 million, and then we can really change things. Then we can maybe, you know, make this world a place where we can live and thrive and have a future.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And yeah, just acknowledging these things, acknowledging that it is high level malfeasance, well organized over several decades. And that it isn't something that you know, it isn't left versus right. It isn't Gloria Steinem versus Phyllis Schlafly. You know,
yeah.
You know, it's you know, that's how to, you know, that's how the conventional view looks at it. You know, it's, you know, Gloria Steinem leftists, the counterculture. No, no, no. Gloria Steinem's a CIA agent. And once you realize she's CIA, then all of a sudden, all types of questions start being asked. Like, what's going on here? That's what you need to do. Yeah.
Yeah. There's an article that was in the New Yorker about Steinem. And it was, I really thought this was something that, that the public should kind of get a sense on. And it was written by, right, it was in the New Yorker. It was written by a woman named Jane Kramer. Like to know more about Jane. And it just gave this basically completely PR version of Steinem's life, right? Mm. Didn't mention anything about the CIA activity. Didn't mention anything about the Red Stockings statement about her. Didn't mention anything about Ms. Magazine's funding by Catherine Graham and of her relationships into Project Mockingbird, right? Mm-hmm. Where researchers have found that she was basically the point person for Project Mockingbird, right? I mean, it's just insane. And so this article came out in October of 2015. And I was thinking I would write an article about this, showing what is fake news.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, saying, look, here are the claims that this Jane Kramer makes about Steinem's life. And here are the facts that you can actually go and look at. You know, you can actually look at the letter that between Dulles and Chester Bowles talking about how India needs to be, you know, have some indoctrination work, right? This was written before Steinem gets the Chester Bowles, you know, scholarship to go to India. You can see, you know, the fact that that the book she claimed to write, A Thousand Indias, doesn't exist, that the Red Stockings did all this research into it. And then you can just go through all of these facts. You can say, look, here she is in the Helsinki Youth Festival. Here are the Finnish reports on the CIA's attempt to disrupt the CIA's effort to do violence in these areas. And here's their opinion that Steinem is involved in all of this. Here's Steinem's own admission about being a CIA agent, which is just basically, you know, she just tries to blow it off. And then here are all of the facts concerning the creation of Ms. Magazines, all of these connections into the CIA, into Project Mockingbird, and back to this exact same people that she was working with the Independent Research Service when she started the whole thing, right? So when you put those facts into the little puff piece that Jane Kramer wrote, then you have real news. Then you got something that people can actually, you know, well, I think we can make a little bit of forward progress here in understanding of culture. And then you look at that. You look at the facts that were left out compared to what she put in there, and you can see what fake news really is. It's propaganda. Mm-hmm. It's there to socialize you. It's there. Jane Kramer wrote something with the idea that she would basically make people incapable of thinking about Steinem as someone who perverted culture.
Yeah, because they're perpetuating these myths, and people have no idea what's been done to them. How can they even
start to correct
the situation? They don't know that they've been test rats in a massive social engineering project. You know, it's like when you hear watch the news and you'll hear they'll talk about the anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and they'll just repeat the official narrative, which is, you know, absurd. The same with RFK or Martin Luther King, and there's not even an acknowledgement that there's, you know, a lot of controversy and doubt regarding the official narrative. They just repeat it, even though the fact that even regarding JFK, the strong majority don't buy the lone gunman, you know, single lone gunman approach. But they keep repeating it.
And they just keep socializing, and it has some effect. But, you know, I am hopeful that 9-1-1 is just indigestible in terms of the propaganda machine. You know, more and more people are just kind of realizing that could not possibly have, Building 7's collapse just could not be anything other than controlled demolition. And the fact that it isn't being discussed in the media.
Yeah, it's just what an indictment. What an indictment.
Speaks volumes. Now you can really see the organized malevolence, right? I mean, Steinem's the way that they puff piece Steinem is obviously, you know, this is malevolence, but to not be discussing the collapse of Building 7, right? Well, this means that this is just the white, you know, this is the third rail. And but you see, the fact that they don't, that tells you that it's starting to cut, right? Yeah. That because if they thought that they could just, you know, puff piece the whole thing, they would actually be doing it. The fact that there is a complete blackout, and I mean, Tim, I've been looking for when are they going to be doing the analysis? Because I kept thinking, well, they'll do some kind of socialization to get people away from the belief that it's controlled demolition, but it hasn't come. And I'm sure that the reason it hasn't is because they know it, or they've studied it and they realize that, hey, wait a second, we're going to lose control of this narrative, right? And this just leads, just like, you know, Gordon Wasson's pay requisition to start the counterculture, or Gloria Steinem's role as a CIA agent, it leads right back to the big question. What in the hell are these intelligence agencies doing? Who's in back of them, you see? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, you know, even though, it's a bleak world, but Tim, there's a lot of little points of light, maybe 1,000. To use an expression.
Yeah, there's no reason to get depressed about it because there's so much work to do. Who has time to be depressed?
Yeah, there's just a lot of work to do. And this is exactly right. This is what, you know, I get the, you know, people ask me this. They go, well, you know, I feel depressed. What do you do? And I go, look, the first thing you have to recognize is the fact that your depression is their victory. You have been socialized into being depressed. This is just conditioning. The correct response is to say, you know, yeah, they want me to be depressed, but you know what? I actually want to keep living and breathing and have like a life for my family and a future. So you know what? I'm just going to overcome their conditioning and just work all the harder to bring change about. And I'm not going to respond to the depression with inactivity or the fear with paralysis. I'm just going to recognize that these are just psychological apparatuses that have been put into me. And the right response is, once I know that they're there, is they should energize, right? They should be energizing you, because you can see that you have been damaged by these bastards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have not, it's not just theoretical, they have damaged you. And so you want to get over the socialization. You know, one thing I like to do is just talk about 911 in public places. You know, I always bring it up and I go, oh, yeah, the government did that. And, you know, people will be shocked. But then occasionally, and I mean more and more, people aren't shocked, Tim.
Yeah, more people.
They go, yeah, I've heard this. Yeah, it's very, you know, it's happening. So, you know, this is why we just need to keep developing our information resources, you know, like, and also keep developing our courage. You know, speak out. Don't be silent. Speak out. If you really want to have, a public, courageous leader come to basically spearhead, you know, a local movement, you can hire Tim Kelly.
So. Let 100 flowers bloom, huh?
Absolutely, brother.
Okay, Joe. Well, I'll let you go.
All right. Well, thank you, Tim. It's been a real pleasure, and hope to talk to you soon.
Yeah, we'll talk soon again. Wither the white male.
Yeah, that's right.
One of these things where it's people just assume that they have it all, they have the power. But listen, I have not yet got an invitation from the power elite, all the white males, the bankers, or whether it's Gates or whether it's
all those guys, the guild, right?
Yeah,
you know, I was looking at a list of
it doesn't trickle down to the common white man. So
yeah, no, it doesn't. You know, I was looking at a list of media personalities that they had linked to the CIA. This was in the 70s. And it was everybody. I mean, everybody was either like CFR, CIA. I mean, the entire media cohort is a secret society.
Mm-hmm.
They come on, they have their smiling faces, you know, and they, oh, gee, Tom, oh, gee, Gene, and, you know, and they roll their eyes when they talk about conspiracy theory. Man, the whole thing is just a bloody weaponized anthropology pageant. You know, turn that crap off. That's something I hope we can do a show on, is the Operation Mockingbird. You know, it's related to some of the stuff we've been talking about, but
yeah,
they've really got a lot of data now about media personalities that the CIA had basically either bought off or had control over or were members of the CFR. I think that's really good for the public to know that it helps them understand that the media is completely fake.
Yeah. And once you realize that, then it's like, okay, then that's what you have to, that has to be your starting point.
Let's get down to work and get some real facts. Yeah. It's just like the Gloria, like Jane Kramer's insane, you know, mind-numbing life of Gloria Steinem article in the New Yorker. I mean, you know, it's useful to use as a starting point for real analysis, but you're using, you know, just to see how they're basically trying to socialize us.
Yeah, just from a journalistic standpoint, the real story is so much more interesting, you think.
Yeah.
Someone would write about it, you know. Well, no.
Well, yes. Well, don't you think someone would write about the fact that Gloria Steinem was a CIA agent and then lied about it? And then other feminists called her on it. And then after the fact, then suddenly it turned out that this Operation Mockingbird had come in, was in existence. And, oh, by the way, everybody involved in the Ms. Magazine is a member, the financing. You'd think that would be a pretty good story. Something would be kind of interesting for old Jane Kramer to write about. The New Yorker might find it kind of interesting. But it isn't going to happen because those magazines are all under the same, you know, guild control. So it's not going to happen. But it's too late for them, Tim, because your show happens.
Yeah, and many others,
And your audience is growing. It is growing. And this is a lot different than the New Yorker, New York Times, CNN. Their audiences are collapsing. So good things are happening, brother.
That's right. I have a better growth trajectory.
You have a growth trajectory.
Whereas
they have a death trajectory because a lot of people now just realize that they're just fake.
Yeah, it's why even bother? Why even bother?
It's just a way. And they shouldn't bother because exposing themselves to those things, it just exposes themselves to weaponized anthropology.
Yeah, fear, misinformation, disinformation. Yeah. If you ever just subject yourself to like a couple hours of regular programming, you realize how bad it is. I occasionally have to watch it because of where I am at a given moment, and it's just amazing to me.
Yeah, well, you know, it's
the
like
BS that they're pulling. It's just.
You ever seen the movie Manchurian Candidate?
Yeah.
And you've seen these like laboratories where they pull the guys in and they like, you know, put pins in their brains and you know, well, I mean, that's our media,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's like instead of CNN, instead of seeing, the smiling face of Wolf Blitzer, if you had like the doctors with their like gizmos put in your head, but that would be the real picture. You see, then you'd know that's really what it is, you know. You know, they should take CNN should have like the introduction to the gizmo, you know, brain, you know, messing around room that's in the Manchurian Candidate films, and then they would be at least honest about what they are.
No, they have the graphics, they have the good looking women that occasionally sue you.
Yeah. Like I know, Fox that's right. News. Well, that's, you know, again, these are just these media theatrics, you know, they're just there to distract.
Yeah, now the media,
so stupid.
The news media is now the news. I mean, that's just.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's right. It is sort of fascinating how this is slowly happening where more and more it's like the news media is the news. Fake news, O'Reilly's sexual, you know, harassment thing. But. You know, it's they're doing this to try to drive people away from the news. I think they can start to see the Tim Kelly effect is coming on, but it's too late. There's too many of us.
Just over the weekend, where I was at my brother's house, everyone's talking about that, and I said, it's no big deal. The casting couch has been around forever. I don't care. It's show business. Women know the terms. don't do it. You sell your soul. I would say, ask someone, what would you do? I would tell a young girl not to go into show business because you sell your soul.
Absolutely.
And that's what you do. There's no way to get around it. I'm not shocked by it at all. It's wrong. Of course it's wrong. I don't know if it's illegal or not. Just no one has a right to be a Fox anchor news babe.
I mean,
just watch the show. Why do you think these women are hired? Give me a break.
Exactly. It's an organization run by evil, and that demands that the individuals involved with it have to be evil or just so stupid that they can be, you know, just they're like a Delta class in Brave New World.
Yeah. Yeah. Hollywood's the same way. I mean, Hollywood, it's like, it's probably worse out there. But, you know, whatever, you know, so I'm not shocked by it.
Oh, Tim, it's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, great. So
I just feel like you deprogram all of my Manchurian candidates. just getting a chance to chat with you really helps.
And it cuts both ways, so.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for the talk, and I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, great. Listen, have a good evening. When I post this, I'll send you the link. Thanks.
Okay. Appreciate it. Thank you, Tim.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.